Iku Iluna, please rise. Ea ka aha ho o kolo kolo ki eke hanohana ua a koa koa ho maila. This Honorable Supreme Court is now reconvened. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-21-0000364, State of Hawaii.
I can't hear you, I think. Sorry, Dylan, I'm not sure.
Hello, testing. Testing. Can you hear me? Okay. A case number SCWC-21-0000364, State of Hawaii v. Troy D. Borge Jr. Arguing for the petitioner, Hayden Aluli. Arguing for the respondent, Renee Ishikawa DeLizzo. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good afternoon. Aloha, everyone. Mr. Aluli, Ms. DeLizzo. Are you both ready to proceed today? All right. Just to confirm, Mr. Aluli, you've asked for 15 minutes for your initial argument and 15 minutes for rebuttal. So we'll give you a warning at 15 minutes. Ms. DeLizzo, you've asked for a warning with 5 minutes to go. So we'll give you that and then a red light at the end when your time is up. And if either a counsel wishes, you may remove your mask during the proceeding. So please proceed.
Hello, Kako, Chief Justice Brecton Wong, and other Associate Justices of this Honorable Court. I'd like to split my opening argument in two parts and concentrate on the first part of why the ICA gravely erred in affirming the denial of petitioner's motion to dismiss, and secondly, move on to the affirming of the $1 million restitution order. The ICA summary disposition order upholding the indictment must be reversed. The indictment is a result of prosecutorial misconduct in two instances. First, the prosecutor improperly adduced evidence that petitioner had invoked his constitutional right to counsel under both the federal and state constitutions. That constituted misconduct because it undermined the fundamental fairness and the integrity of the grand jury process. The evidence invaded the province of the grand jury or tended to induce other than that which the jurors in an influenced judgment deemed warranted on the evidence fairly presented before them. And the prosecutor's misconduct is presumptively prejudicial. Second, the prosecutor's failure to present clear exculpatory evidence of petitioner's use of force for the protection of others under HRS 703-306 clearly undermined the province of the jury. That clear exculpatory evidence was the tape-recorded statement of eyewitness Keenan Blair. This eyewitness, who was available to testify but not called, at the preliminary hearing on November the 14th, 2019, and at the first grand jury proceeding on November 22nd, 2019, had died in February 1st, 2020. After the circuit court dismissed the first indictment, the prosecutor convened the second grand jury on June 29, 2020. And at this proceeding, he adduced Babe Blair's statements as hearsay through Detective Clinton's testimony. However, this hearsay left out significant parts of Blair's eyewitness account that was clear exculpatory evidence that supported the protection of others under HRS 703-306. Again, this constituted prosecutor misconduct because it undermined the fundamental fairness and the integrity of the grand jury process. This court should reverse the ICA with respect to the first question, and I'm happy to answer any questions the court may have before moving on to the restitution issue.
Mr. Lilly, could you help me with your analysis of the significance of the statement that was made by the officer at the grand jury about the failure of your client to provide a statement? Specifically, why wouldn't Rodriguez apply? You know, Rodriguez, where there was a testimony that was found to, in fact, not require reversal and not constitute prosecutorial misconduct, where the, I think the facts in that case were that there was a question about whether a tape recorded statement was going to be agreed to by the defendant.
Well, I'd like to just point out in answer to your question, Justice Wilson, I'd like to point out the State versus Bodea Close. This is the case that Justice Nakayama, you penned. And in that case, which is almost on all fours in this case, although it had to do with misconduct before a jury trial, you wrote, Justice Nakayama, quote, Bodea Close's right to remain silent was infringed when video footage of his invocation of that right was published to the jury over objection. The jury likely inferred from the video that Bodea Close invoked his right to remain silent when he refused to participate in a reenactment of the incident at the close of his interview. Therefore, pursuant to the standard we set forth in Domingo, State versus Domingo, Bodea Close's invocation of his right to remain silent was used against him at trial in violation of Article 1, Section 10 of the Hawaii Constitution. Now, this is what in Bodea Close, the-
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I assume that you are suggesting Bodea in answer to my question about the degree to which Rodriguez applies.
Yes, Rodriguez, in that case, Your Honor, which was pointed out in my brief, it really had to do with how do you undo basically prosecutorial misconduct. Now, in Bodea Close, the court felt that the jury could infer that there was invocation of right. And in Domingo, again, that was another case where the court had to infer that the excised Miranda waiver form that took out the invocation of right to remain silent, the jury could likely infer the constitutional right in that infringement. So in this case, there's no inference that need to be done here. The prosecutor adduced on the second time, the second grand jury indictment, when the prosecutor well knew that there was a statement not given by the defendant, the petitioner, and that he had invoked his right to counsel. But nevertheless, after the first indictment was dismissed, after the prosecutor convened the second grand jury, he lobbed in this just, in my view, prosecutorial misconduct to the max, because there's no way that you can unring that bell. Of course, the prosecutor tried to unring that bell later when he, at the very end of the grand jury proceeding, he advised the grand jury to disregard the evidence the petitioner had asked for counsel. But
Mr. Lilly, is it your position that a prosecutor cannot cure their own misconduct?
You know, Judge, that's a good point, but I'd like to point to the case that you authored, State versus Harada, Justice.
What's the name of the case again?
It's a State versus Hirata.
Hirata.
And in that case, basically you said that really those types of judicial admonishments are basically particularly effective. You cited the State versus Rivera, where this court recognized, quote, that court instructions often serve as unsatisfactory, ineffectual fix when the prejudicial matter surfaces at trial. Now, in this case, this is not where the grand jury has the presence of a judicial officer dressed in black robes that has the authority to admonish and instruct. Here it is a grand jury proceeding convened in secret by a prosecutor who just lobbed an unconstitutional thing into the jury.
Could a prosecutor actually instruct the grand jury not to consider certain evidence?
Well, I think the record says he tried to.
Well, no, the word was advise.
Yes, advise.
Not even instruct. But I'm wondering, can a prosecutor instruct?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I think he doesn't have the aura that a judicial officer, a judge, would have in a petite jury.
And I think that's what I was suggesting by saying if a prosecutor can cure their own misconduct. What about if an independent grand jury came in and said the same thing?
I think, you know, in my experience of looking at grand jury transcripts, I don't know what the independent grand jury does. I would think that arguably if he did, it might have a different type of impact on the grand jury. But in this case, there was no intervention by an independent grand jury counsel. And it came from the prosecutor's own mouth after he deduced the unconstitutional infringement.
It sounds like your position might be based on citing Harada and Rivera that, you know, you really can't cure something like this. Is that your position?
I think you cannot. And in fact, by trying to cure it, by trying to unring that bell, it may well backfire and emphasize or highlight those jurors that may not have caught it and then hear it later, like, what, I'm not supposed to listen to that? What is that all about?
Let me ask you about that point. And you're an experienced veteran, seasoned trial lawyer. And, you know, is it sometimes the calculus where a trial judge might say, hey, counsel, do you really want me to give you a curative instruction here?
Right. And in those times, trial lawyers may not to try to unring the bell because it may just reinforce that first ring. But in this case, you're right, Your Honor, there are two arguably serious misconducts of ringing the bell and then trying to undo the taint.
Well, Mr. Alouli, let me ask you about this attempt, though, to unring the bell. The information that was given by the prosecutor to the grand jury was, I'm going to advise the grand jury that you're not to consider that information in your deliberation. Does that really fully inform them that they're not supposed to hold that information against the defendant in any way, in the sense of trying to cure what is an implication, perhaps, that the defendant is guilty because he's refusing to give a statement?
That's a good question, Your Honor. And I think that in trying to unring the bell, it was vague, even assuming that a prosecutor can unring the bell. His unringing was ineffective because it was just so vague. And it could not have the really impact that he probably intended to do to undo that taint.
Mr. Alouli, I think Mr. DeLiso is going to make the argument that the officer's statement was non-responsive to the question. So the question was, and you didn't take any statement from Mr. Borges, really calls for a yes or no answer. And the officer, for some reason, went further. Does that matter? In other words, does the intent of the prosecutor and the nature of the question matter if we thought that this was not intentional? Or do you think it does matter that it is intentional and that we could, under the circumstances, draw that inference? What's your take on that?
I think it doesn't matter, Your Honor, because I think the damage is done. And if you wanted to get into was it intentional or not, you look at the context of how the second grand jury, like a last hurrah after the first grand jury was dismissed by a judge, and the prosecutor brought the same detective, asked him the same questions. And the very end, the second one, he has this lob that I think the prosecutor has to take honor for and take responsibility for.
He wasn't asked in the first grand jury?
It was not. And that just puts it in the context of, you know, the zealousness of a prosecutor after losing at a preliminary hearing where the district court found there was no sending up to the circuit court the attempted second-degree murder, convening the first grand jury and getting that grand jury dismissed for excessive use of hearsay, and then convening the incident grand jury. It just doesn't sit right as the context of what did the prosecutor in the contest, can you adduce that he was intentional? I don't think you need to go there because I think the damage is done.
What about the, you want to just address the question of failure to provide exculpatory evidence and in particular, the statement that it appeared the CW might be ready to attack a third person or hit a third person?
I think what happened is the prosecutor used detective's testimony, the hearsay of the eyewitness, not fully. And it is, but for the not fully and accurately playing the tape recorded statements of this unavailable witness who had passed, you would not get the full flavor. And the prosecutors and the detectives' adducement of partial eyewitness testimony.
Don't we require clearly exculpatory? Is the statement clearly exculpatory?
I think, Your Honor, what was left out.
Hint at a possible exculpatory.
I think it's clearly exculpatory because there's nothing to contradict what the eyewitness would have said. And what was left out was clenched fist, walking toward the girlfriend as if going to hit the girlfriend. Also, after hitting the CW, he woke up, stood up, and faced the girlfriend where the petitioner had hit him again. I think that is information that was left out.
No, it was, but looked like he was going to?
Looked like he was going to.
Clearly exculpatory?
I think it is clearly exculpatory because
like
that.
He was about to hit her, but I'm not too sure.
Yes.
You think that's clearly exculpatory?
I think because in the context of what was left out about him waking up, trying to stand again, and then facing Christy, that was left out by the detective's testimony.
Well, I mean, but doesn't it raise the issue to some extent why that was left out? I mean, when we're thinking about how exculpatory it was, would you concede that it was more exculpatory in the initial statement before the initial statement before the grand jury, the first grand jury, when the full statement was given? Would you agree that that was more exculpatory than the truncated one in the subsequent grand jury?
At the first grand jury that was dismissed, the part that was left out in the second part was not even repeated in the first grand jury. Was not.
And so my point is, why would this, what seems to be at least more exculpatory information, have been left out at the last grand jury?
Well, that's why I believe that it was prosecutor misconduct of leaving that out, because it was more favorable to the government not to have the jury consider.
And to an extent, it had been shown to be effective in the previous, for example, in the preliminary hearing, right?
If you're going back to why the circuit court dismissed the first indictment, it was not only because of that. It was because basically the detective testified about the doctor and the nurse, basically, who gave, in my view, it was the totality of the excessive use of hearsay from multiple witnesses. So the point I'm making is that the second grand jury, crucial parts that in my view were clearly exculpatory, were left out, coupled with the lobbying, the invocation of a right to counsel, that constituted clear exculpatory, or the clear prosecutorial misconduct that this court must find is presumptively prejudicial.
What about restitution?
Thank you.
To that issue.
The ICA summary disposition order upholding the more than $1 million restitution order to a complainant when he did not suffer verified losses because his medical expenses.
Did he even request this?
I'm sorry?
Did he even make a request for this?
He did not, Your Honor.
How did this come about?
It came about, and I think because Circuit Court Judge Kawano is probably more versed in a couple of cases he did before this court, where the statute says the court shall order restitution. So when, frankly, the parties came to the first sentencing proceeding, the pre-sentence report made no recommendations of restitution. And in fact, the prosecution, in my belief, wasn't even going to do that, except the court said, hey, the court shall order. I want to supplement what's happened in restitution. So the court basically ordered Special Services Branch to make a report about restitution because the court believed it was his duty to do so under the law.
And then how did the Maui Medical get contacted? Was it the probation officer that had been preparing the PSI that got that information?
My presumption is that when the first PSI came and the court wanted more information as a restitution, Special Services Branch updated and actually contacted the CW's family to actually ask if they really were going to submit restitution.
But they actually requested like $5,600 only for, it was actually the parents' travel expenses.
And yes, you know, at the sentencing, I believed it was reasonable because I was looking at a 10-year sentence, trying to curry favor with the judge, wanted to get probation, certainly didn't want to feel unreasonable.
And you were conceding that, but the judge said, wait a minute, the parents aren't the victim, right?
He basically said the complainant is the victim. And under Tua Ali'i, that the court felt that despite the Aloha Cares payment.
But he wasn't going to give the airfare for the parents, right?
Well, I think it was all included.
It was included in that $1.4 million?
So,
what do you think about that case? Do we need to overrule that to reach the outcome you advocate for, or is it reconcilable?
I think, first off, if the court finds that the grand jury indictment must be dismissed, then you can save this $1 million restitution order for another court day. But if not, then I think the court, after 14 years of seeing the couple cases that have come up with dissents, in one case that you handled, Judge, in the DeMello case, Justice Nakayama, you had Pollack and Perkins dissent over, kind of construing what is criminal restitution and how do we figure out what it is. And it's a thorny issue. I think if you can follow the plain and unambiguous language that a layperson, as I read the statute, when I came into sentencing, my argument was, Judge, you follow the plain and unambiguous language, and did the complainant suffer verifiable losses? And losses, in my view, talk about when you look at the statute, you can pay medical expenses. And what's an expense? An expense is when you pay. You pay something out. It's a cost. Under like of theft of value, you get the cost of replacement. It is the cost of a medical expense. And we know that the complainant did not pay the cost for his medical care. Now,
did the complainant request reimbursement for medical expenses other than I saw something about $100 for dental?
Yes.
But I didn't see a request for, did I miss something? Was there a request for additional medical expenses?
What happened is the court felt that all the expenses that were paid by Aloha Care.
No, but my question is, did the victim, the complainant, make a request for medical expenses other than the $100 for dental?
How I saw it go down, Your Honor, it was a report from special branches that came in, not from the victim. And frankly, not even from the victim under the statute, not even from the government entity that had a right to come in and ask restitution, that never did occur.
Yeah, that I was going to ask you that, Mr. Lulli. Is there anything in the record? First of all, would you agree Aloha Care is a governmental entity within the meaning of the statute?
Yes.
Okay. And is there anything in the record to indicate that they had made a request for the reimbursement for these expenses?
No, Your Honor. And so when you look at the plain and unambiguous language, it would result in just an absurd result for $1 million payoff to a complainant. It would be such a windfall. Now, I do know for the 20 years or so, the country's been marching on about victim rights, federal, right, and to a B. But, you know, there are some questions that are arising across the nation that are questioning that restitution. And that is recently the Supreme Court was faced with dissents from Hester versus United States. And there are two dissents and a certiorari raised the issue of restitution. And Justice Sotomayor and Justice Gorsuch wrote a dissent questioning, really, does criminal restitution, has it involved under Apprendi? Is this something that should be alleged in the charging document? Is the restitution, should it be proved beyond a reasonable doubt before a jury? And in this case, $1 million restitution to someone who did not pay out for those medical expenses just raises the issue of cruel and unusual punishment. And I do know that on the
case. What did you say, cruel what?
Cruel and unusual punishment.
And?
Cruel and unusual.
Does our Constitution say and?
I can't say.
It says cruel or unusual punishment.
Cruel or unusual. But I think it would be both, Your Honor. So I think my time is up. Have I answered your question, Your Honor?
Very well. Anything further from the court? No, at this point we'll hear from Ms. DeLizzo. Thank you, Mr. Thank Lulli. You.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Hawaii Supreme Court. May it please the court, Renee Ishikawa DeLizzo, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney, appearing for the state of Hawaii. This case is about a terrible assault. The petitioner, Troy D. Borge Jr., assaulted Briar Brossart, bashing the victim in the head with a stick the size of a baseball bat. The victim was in a coma for 17 days, but he lived.
Counsel, this is not a jury trial. Can we focus on the legal issues in this case, please?
Yes. The victim in this case asked for restitution at the trial court, and the trial court awarded the restitution for the hospital bills. This case goes beyond that tragic incident. This case is also about discretion. We argue that there was no prosecutorial misconduct at grand jury, and the trial court did not abuse its discretion in ordering restitution. To try to pick up on some of the issues that were raised today, first of all, as to the indictment. Indictments are presumed to be valid. There is a presumption in Hawaii case law that is given to an indictment. So it is petitioner's duty, if he is to challenge it, to overcome that presumption. There was no improper conduct at the grand jury. Contrary to what the petitioner is arguing, the prosecutor did not imply guilt or comment on the right to remain silent by asking the detective the question of whether petitioner made a statement.
How is that not commenting on a right to remain silent by asking if he made a statement?
The form of the question, Your Honor, was a leading question. Clearly the-
It's a yes or no answer.
Yes. Right?
So you're saying if he made a statement, it would be okay then? Well, why is it even asked in a grand jury proceeding? To what end would that be a legitimate question?
Well, for two reasons. First is that we have to take the question in context of the line of questioning that the deputy prosecutor was attempting to elicit as to how the detective investigated the case. So that is the context in which he asked if upon contact with the petitioner, he made a statement.
Well, help me with that. I mean, the line of questioning has to do with the injuries that he received. And the injuries that he received end up with an answer that questions about the injuries end up with an answer that says we attempted to question him, but he requested to speak with an attorney. It seems like there was a break from the line of questioning where there was a statement volunteered by the detective. And I know that in your view, it didn't have any incriminating aspect to it, but it seemed that the prosecutor felt differently, right? The prosecutor felt this was enough of a problem, perhaps enough of an incriminating problem, that the prosecutor tried to remedy it with his own instruction, right?
He gave the curative instruction because clearly he was not expecting the detective to give an embellished answer. He was expecting...
Well, I'm not sure it had to do with embellished. I think it probably had to do with his concern about the possibility that there had been a comment on the defendant's failure or refusal to give a statement.
What if the answer had been, and you didn't take any statement from Mr. Borge? No. How is that proper?
Again, we, the...
No, he didn't give a statement. How would that be proper?
That's not improper, Your Honor, with all due respect. It's asking what happened when the detective investigated the case. Second, it's also forestalls any question that the grand jury might have when they are hearing this case. They might be wondering in the back of their minds if petitioner made a statement or not.
So is in any given grand jury, if the defendant decides to exercise his post-arrest constitutional rights, is it your position the deputy prosecuting attorney can ask the detective whether the defendant made a statement?
We don't see any improper conduct as to whether or not a statement, asking the witness whether a statement has been made.
Is there a difference between a grand jury and, I mean, could they ask that during a trial?
That would be up to the trial court. And the beauty of our system is that we have discretion in the system, and the trial court, when it got to trial, would be able to determine under the facts and circumstances of the case whether that question could be asked or not. Here, the grand jury, we have to allow the prosecutor to have the discretion to present the case.
Well, let me ask you this, because you said that the reason why the prosecutor asked that question was for the steps that the detective was taking. But the questioning of the detective first was simply, was there a case that you were involved in? Yes, it was the Beach case. And then all the detective testified to was Ms. Capuni. I showed, it was like a photo lineup with Ms. Capuni. Then the detective asks the prosecutor asks the statement about the detective, and there's the answer. And then the only remaining thing the detective testified to was the hearsay comments about Dr. Dinesh. So I'm just wondering how you can say that the question, and you didn't take any statement from Mr. Borge, has anything to do with the steps the detective took in this case.
That is our view, Your Honor, in line of Rodriguez.
Well, Rodriguez is interesting. Help me with that in the sense, Ms. DeLisa, that in Rodriguez, it seemed that a statement was given, actually. There was a statement given about the concept, the theft. But then the officer asked, if I recall the case correctly, if there would be an oral statement made, a recorded statement. And from that point of view, the defendant decided that he wasn't going to give a recorded statement. But I would think that one might find this to be far more of an incriminating statement that was elicited during the course of the questioning by the prosecutor, because in this case, the issue was whether he would give any statement at all, which sounds even less cooperative and perhaps more of an indication of guilt than in Rodriguez, where there was a statement given to the detective.
I think what the deputy prosecutor was trying to prevent was a question later by the grand jury about whether petitioner made a statement.
Wait a second. The first grand jury proceeding, according to defense counsel, the question was never asked, did he give a statement, right? And in that proceeding? Was there a question from the grand jury, jurors?
No, I don't recall, Your Honor. I don't know, however, if the same grand jury panel sat on this second indictment. That is speculation, so we are speculating.
Well, if that were true, according as what Justice Wilson said, why would he, if that was an appropriate question, why did he later advise the grand jury to ignore it?
Clearly, because the deputy was not expecting the detective to say more than yes or no. And in fact, State versus Scotland in Hawaii case law points to us that if it's a non-responsive answer, it's clearly was not implied the intent of the prosecutor to comment from.
But isn't, you know, here's the question. And you didn't take any statement from Mr. Borge. That's the question. The answer, we attempted to question him, but he requested to speak to an attorney. And you're saying that that's non-responsive, but isn't no statement sort of by extension because they requested an attorney? It doesn't seem non-responsive at all. It almost seems that it's inferred. I mean, it's an absolute inference that, you know, I didn't give a statement because I asked for an attorney. I mean, so how is that non-responsive?
It's not all the time that people decide not to give a statement because they want an attorney. Some people will just refuse to make a statement, Your Honor.
So would that have been a proper? So, yeah, please help me here because I'm starting to get a little bit confused, candidly. So it would have been okay for him to ask, did you take a statement from the defendant? And if the response had been, no, the defendant did not give a statement, that would have been okay.
Yes, we see no error in that.
That does not, in the state's view, that does not infringe upon implicating the defendant's right against self-incrimination.
It's not inferring guilt from asking that question.
I see. So in your view, in the state's view, you could ask this question every single time in the grand jury then.
I think it depends on the facts and circumstances of the case that have to be weighed.
Let me follow up on that question. So let's assume in this case, the question from the prosecutor was more direct. And the prosecutor said, in this case, you tried to get a statement, but you couldn't get it because the defendant decided to ask for an attorney. In your view, that would have been an appropriate leading question by the prosecutor?
No, that would have been inappropriate. And I think the deputy prosecutor's curative instruction or advisement did say, tell the grand jury not to consider whether or not he invoked that right to remain silent.
If we were to determine that it's a logical response when the question is asked, did you take a statement for the detective or the witness that's being asked that question to say, I tried to take a statement, but I couldn't get one because the defendant decided to ask for an attorney. If we find that that would be a logical result, then would you agree then that it's a question that does ask for an incriminating response?
If it's that full length of the answer, yes, but clearly in this case, that was not what the deputy was trying to get to.
Okay, what the deputy was trying to get to whether or not he made a statement. Would you agree to that?
Yes.
Okay, now this is a probable cause determination.
Correct.
Whether he makes a statement or not, why would the prosecutor want to put the failure of the defendant to make a statement in it, other than to color the proceedings, in a probable cause determination?
Beyond the procedures that the detective took, beyond that would be a question to forestall any question that the grand jury themselves might have in their back of their mind and ask.
So if the grand jury had asked that question, the prosecutor would have said, Detective, please go ahead and answer that question.
the prosecutor, if allowed to ask a question and follow up, might have asked the same question, a yes or no leading question.
So is this asked at every grand jury proceeding to forestall questions as to whether or not the defendant made a statement?
I can't say, Your Honor, for every proceeding. In this case, that is what likely happened.
Does it matter that the actual question was you didn't take any statement? Does that imply that the officer didn't initiate a statement, or is that not a real significant distinction in your view? Does the exact wording of the question that was used in any way mitigate the possible prejudicial impact?
These are nuances playing on words. We're just arguing the general principle of whether or not someone made a statement is not in itself improper conduct.
Do you think the context matters, however? Because this question did arise right after the question saying, so the next day you arrested the defendant. Did you see any injuries on the defendant? No. So clearly the detective is with the defendant. And then he says, you didn't take a statement. Doesn't that imply that, you know, he was with the defendant and the defendant was refusing to speak? I mean, it's different from saying, it's even, in my view, it's a little worse than the detective never even saw the defendant and the detective didn't give a statement. I mean, the defendant didn't give a statement. It's, you're with the guy, but he's not given a statement. I mean, what is the jury to take from that? The grand jury to take from that? Doesn't that imply that he was refusing to speak?
It does, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you for that concession.
But you said that it's proper. You think it's proper?
That he refused to speak?
That the comment can be made during a grand jury proceeding that the defendant exercises his right to remain silent?
We don't view that as a comment, Your Honor. We're not saying that because of this, his not making a statement, therefore you should find it, indict him. We're not going that route.
But you are saying it's not improper for a jury, grand juror, to infer that the defendant exercised his right to remain silent?
The case law does not speak as to what the grand jury inferred, although the all reasonable inferences to be drawn are to be made, but we're looking at the viewpoint of what the prosecutor intended at his question.
And you're saying it's okay, though. Didn't you just say that? It's okay for the prosecutor to ask whether the defendant made a statement.
Yes.
So it's okay for the prosecutor to inferentially, if the prosecutor knew that the defendant didn't make a statement, it's okay for the prosecutor to infer that the defendant exercised his right to remain silent?
For the grand jury to make that inference?
You just said that it's up to what the prosecutor wanted and what the prosecutor did. So I'm right. Just saying if the prosecutor asked that, you're saying it's appropriate, it's okay to infer that the defendant exercised his right to remain silent.
We weren't asking the grand jury to infer anything from that statement question.
Could you at this point address the issue of exculpatory evidence, and in particular, the witness statement that it appeared the defendant might have been on the verge of hitting a third party, or it seemed like he might.
Yes. Your Honor, I think we're talking about the grand jury hearing on June 26, 2020. And in the grand jury hearing, detective did not testify as to what Mr. Blair said, so we don't see how that would have been hearsay. As far as committed by the detective, as far as...
Was it actually Capone that had said that previously?
Well, Ms. Capone was there at the scene, and she did testify at the grand jury of what she saw. but petitioner was making the argument of hearsay due to the detective talking about Mr. Blair's statement, I believe, which didn't happen at that grand jury that resulted in the indictment of this case. Furthermore, as Justice Nakayama pointed out, the definition of clearly exculpatory evidence was not present because of that statement. It did not clearly negate petitioner's guilt. So we don't find it to be.
I think the issue, I'm sorry to interrupt, but on that point, if you could help me, I thought the argument that was being made by the appellant was that there was information left out before the last grand jury from the Blair statement that would have been more exculpatory. Is that correct?
There was, well, it depends on the definition of what you find to be clearly exculpatory.
Well, this is why this is a useful oral argument, because I get to determine what is exculpatory and getting the benefit of your point of view. So do you think the information that was left out, such as the complaining witness going towards the victim with a clenched fist and moving in that direction, was information that would be exculpatory?
Not clearly exculpatory, Your Honor. It did not clearly negate guilt.
Okay, so it sounds like you're agreeing, at least from your point of view, that could have been exculpatory. In other words, if the jury thought that what was really happening was a defendant was trying to defend somebody that looked like they were about to be assaulted, that might be considered to be relevant to a defense of others.
It might be relevant, Your Honor.
Okay, but it's not clear that it's exculpatory to you. Why wouldn't that be clear? If it adds direct evidence to a self-defense claim.
Because we get to the point of where do we draw the line of what is exculpatory or not? And case law points to the fact that if we make the grand jury a mini trial, the defendant is going to claim that any evidence is exculpatory and should be presented, and will end up at a trial at the grand jury. It's not clearly negating the guilt that happened through that statement of Mr. Blair.
To your knowledge, is there what was a defense that the defendant intended to bring in this case? Was there any defense other than self-defense or defense of others? Does the record say? I mean, I'm not asking you to intuit what was in his mind. Is there anything in the record that addresses that issue?
I don't recall anything directly said about what the defense would have been, Your Honor.
But don't we, in the Wong case, it seems to be case specific, and we're sort of looking at, how important is that particular evidence in the context of the case? An alibi witness, not directly contradicted by any other witness, who maintained the accused was nowhere near the scene. Sole eyewitness testifying as to the perpetration of the crime has perjured himself before the grand jury. In this case, if really the only evidence that's out there, and again, if you don't know, that's okay, but it seems like this was the evidence that would have been the foundation of a defense, that he thought he needed to act to defend this third party. And in that context, doesn't its exclusion rise to the level of clearly exculpatory?
That's a judgment call, and the prosecutor, in his discretion, made the call not to present that statement. That's a matter for trial.
Why do you think that decision was made to not include those statements?
Again,
you had some testimony about what it was that Blair said. Why leave this out?
We didn't find it to be clearly exculpatory. The physical behavior of what Mr. Blair saw, the physical description of the petitioner with clenched fists, looking angry, walking doesn't necessarily mean he's going to assault someone. It can be that he was just very angry. We don't find that to be clearly negating the guilt of the petitioner.
You think a reasonable juror would like to have that information in order to decide what the intent was of the defendant who's being, well, I guess you could say who's being put in a position to be charged with attempted murder?
We don't find that to be what we're looking at. Probable cause. It's more than suspicion, but less than certainty. We don't have
evidence have to be evidence that would negate guilt in order for it to be clearly exculpatory.
Yes.
So would the evidence that he had was walking with the victim with a clenched fist and angry, does that negate the guilt of the defendant?
It would in terms of exculpatory, but we're arguing it's not clearly exculpatory.
You want to address the restitution issue?
Yes, on the restitution, first of all, court was asking about how the claim was initiated. Sorry to say I was not the trial attorney, but in reading the April 9, 21 hearing when sentencing was first heard, it did appear that the court received an addendum at that point. And I don't believe there was anything on the record about the court soliciting the hospital bills. But I stand to be corrected if that is not correct. In terms of the calculation of the $1.4 million, adding up the totals of those two sets of hospital bills is what the $1.4 million turned out.
Right, the $5,600 was not awarded, correct?
Yes.
The court did not believe that the parents were victims under the statute.
Apparently not, Your Honor.
But the court determined Aloha Care was a victim?
No, he didn't. The judge did not say that. He did say that based on two ali'i that it...
Do you think that Tui Ali'i was correctly decided?
Yes, Your Honor. It's based on the collateral source rule, which stems in civil law, which Your Honors are probably more aware than me, but that allows the plaintiff or the injured party to recover the full extent, regardless of whether insurance made payment. And that stands in civil law. If we change criminal law, it's going to impact civil law. And do we really want to do that?
Well, actually, no. That is a common law doctrine. Is restitution under 706-646 a common law remedy?
Restitution, Your Honor, would be a common law.
But the statutory restitution, is that a common law remedy? Actually, restitution is an equitable remedy. So it's not technically a common law remedy. And, you know, if this was a civil case, wouldn't the defendant being charged with this have a right to a jury trial and to contest the reasonableness and the necessity? I mean, was there even any testimony as to whether the billing reflected was reasonably necessary and incurred and whether the charges were fair and reasonable? I mean, is there any such evidence, foundational evidence that would even be required in a civil case for an award of damages of this nature?
Well, in this particular proceeding, there were the bills submitted under declaration of the hospital to authenticate that these charges were incurred for Mr. Brossard during these time periods. And we'd like to point out that plaintiff had full opportunity to challenge the bills, but he decided not to. And so we went, the trial court continued the hearing to allow that challenge as to whether all the charges made were for this case. But that was not pursued.
So, yeah. Tui Ali'i, as I recall, dealt with a situation in which someone, I think, stole money from a company And the company was actually insured for those losses. And the court, ICA said that, you know, this requiring restitution here furthers the goal of rehabilitating the defendant. And I noticed in that case that the defendant was on probation, I think 4 years probation. And apparently the defendant had ability to earn money and repay, I assume. In this case, what was the sentence?
10 years.
10 years imprisonment. So how is imposing $1.4 million in restitution, how does that rehabilitate a defendant that's in prison?
We should impose a sentence that reflects the crime. And he should have to pay for the crime, the losses to the victim. It should not depend on what type of sentence you get as to how much you pay restitution. So our position is that the restitution here was correct.
So if this had been a life without parole, you know, it still, it serves the goals of rehabilitation of the defendant to impose the $1.4 million restitution order also.
That would be up to the trial court, Your Honor. Thank you. Thank you for your consideration of our arguments.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. DeLizzo. Mr. Aluli, your rebuttal.
Thank you for my ability to reply to the prosecution's argument. You know, I think it's dangerous in any proceeding, in a criminal proceeding, for a prosecutor to deduce evidence of whether a statement was taken or not. Because it just, whatever the answer is going to be, if it's like no, it's going to be why not. Now, at a grand jury, we do know hearsay and even Mirandized or even illegally obtained statements can come in as admissions. So there's always gonna be grand jury testimony, defendant did this, said this, that. But I don't see any reason for a prosecutor to ask directly, after talking about injuries, which basically, in my view, was intentional to talk about, did you see any injuries on the defendant? Because he's comparing the injuries on the complainant. Did you see any injuries in the defendant? No. Well, you didn't. Did you take a statement? Now, the prosecutor knew there was no statement taken. That was in discovery. There's no doubt about it. So why did he ask that? And he takes the burden, or he takes responsibility for having it come out that the defendant invoked his constitutional right. And as a matter of law, under the case of Boudet Close and the case that was cited, Domingo Rule, it is, as a matter of per se, that is an infringement. And if you did it in the trial, that will constitute a mistrial. You do it in a grand jury, that impermissibly, it's just unfair. It impermissibly invades the province of a grand jury. And for that, this case should be reversed.
Mr. Lilly, yes. Did you want to respond to the point that actually the information that was provided in the Blair statement was exculpatory but not clearly exculpatory? Specifically the information that was omitted before the last grand jury?
I think the information that was left out intentionally by the detective raised clearly exculpatory evidence. And the transcript was of Blair Keenan, was attached to my moving papers down below, and it is also attached in the pre-sentence report. And the part that was left out was a statement, Rabbit, that's the complainant, had his clenched fist and was walking closer towards Chrissy, that's the girlfriend. Left out also the part about...
How does that negate guilt?
I'm sorry?
How does that negate guilt?
It raises the inference that there is a statutory justification defense as a matter of law. And I think the grand jury, if you are, and it wasn't contradicted. Now...
But they're not talking about the actual altercation or anything like that. It's just talking about something that happened before.
Right.
How does that negate guilt?
Because it raises the inference that the force that was used by the petitioner was justified for the protection of his girlfriend, given the complainant's angriness, clenched fist, swearing, moving toward, and that caused, in my view, clearly exculpatory evidence because it's not contradicted. Now, Capuni, she testified at the preliminary hearing and at both grand jury proceedings, she was asleep. She didn't see the first part of it. Didn't see the original encounter between the complainant and the girlfriend and Troy. So that to me, under the law, is it's not contradicted. It raises a defense, and I believe it's clearly exculpatory. But getting back to the prosecutors asking that question, there was no relevance to it. And he knew that it would no statement. I probably think after losing at the complaint hearing, after having his first indictment dismissed for attempted murder, this is his last shot, and he took it. But there is consequences. Waiting 13 questions later at the end, trying to advise the jury to disregard that invocation of a constitutional right, that was too late.
Mr. Lulli, what's the remedy that the defendant seeks? Dismissal with prejudice, without prejudice? And if with prejudice, what would the reasoning be?
I think if you look at the Wong case, where the prosecutor in that case infringed upon the constitutional common law privilege of attorney-client communication. And the Supreme Court felt that that was over the line, disregarded the rules. And the Wong decision talked about, you know, privileges are codified in the Hawaii rules of evidence. And also privileges under the state and federal constitutions or other privileges that are by precedent. In this case, like Wong, the prosecutor trumped and trampled that constitutional privilege. He brought it full force. In fact, in my view, knowing that there was no statements given, and the Wong court dismissed and remanded an order dismissal with prejudice because that flagrant disregard of a constitutional right was front and center. I'd ask the court for a dismissal indictment with a remand to the district court to dismiss with prejudice because of the flagrant misconduct before the grand jury.
Mr. Lulli, you earlier in response to questioning said that Aloha Care is a governmental entity.
Yes, I think it is, Your Honor.
I thought it was a nonprofit health care coverage type of thing.
You know, Judge, I do know that, I do know some friends that get Aloha Care. I had always thought it was like a governed entity. So
I understood it to be a nonprofit that was set up by Hawaii Community Health Centers, but I understood it to be a nonprofit.
Okay, then, Your Honor, to the extent that I have misconstrued
Because the government exception, the victim governmental entity was intended really for Medicaid.
Right.
And recovery.
And for my representations was a misunderstanding. I just
like assumed. DSSH payments.
I stand corrected, Your Honor.
All right.
Very well. Anything further, Mr. Lulli?
Nothing further. And thank you for this opportunity.
All right. Thank you to both of our attorneys for your argument today. The court will take this matter under advisement. At this point, I'd like to acknowledge that today is a very significant moment in the history of our court. Our dear friends and colleagues, Justice Paula Nakayama and Justice Michael Wilson, will be retiring this year in April after a combined total of more than 50 years service in the judiciary. We don't have any more oral arguments scheduled before the retirement. I guess you never know. Maybe something will come up, but I think it's pretty clear that this is going to be the last time that this court will sit together in oral argument on this bench. They both made an incredible impact as members of this court and more broadly in the life of the judiciary and in our community. Justice Wilson with regard to criminal justice reform and our environmental court. Justice Nakayama with regard to judicial education, the bar licensing process, children in foster care, just to name a few. So between the two of them, they've had an indelible impact on us as an institution. So I just would ask that you all join me in acknowledging their combined 50 years of service. No further business.
Eku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'oku ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolokolo ki ike hanohano o kamaku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.